Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Adam Johnson is winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his acclaimed novel about North Korea, The Orphan Master's Son. Critics have compared him to Kurt Vonnegut, David Mitchell, and George Saunders. Johnson's latest collection of stories is Fortune Smiles. It is subtly surreal, darkly comic, both hilarious and heartbreaking. It is a collection of stories that gives voice to the perspectives we don't often hear, while offering a new way of looking at the world. In six stories, Johnson delves deep into love and loss, natural disasters, the influence of technology, and how the political shapes the personal. The collection was just named a National Book Award finalist. It's a pleasure to welcome Adam Johnson to this week's Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a great joy to return. Thank you.
So the last time you were here, you were talking about The Orphan Master's Son, and of course this was before you won a Pulitzer Prize. So the minute you win the award, like we rerun the show and say, oh, look who we had on.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's your vision.
How did you react to that, and how has that changed your life as a writer?
Well, the Pulitzer Committee doesn't let you know. There's no long list or nominations. They just announce it to the media. So I learned via a bunch of tweets, about 500 tweets that came in 5 minutes. It was a great surprise. I hadn't, had that date marked on my calendar or anything. I actually sat down with my wife, and we know people who've won the Pulitzer Prize, and we've seen it change their lives. And I said to her, this could change us. And we took a few minutes on our couch in San Francisco, and we took stock of our wonderful kids and the schools they go to and the city we live in and how lucky I am to teach at Stanford. And we didn't want anything to change. And so we made a deal to pretend it never happened.
And you've been able to do that.
Well, people regularly remind me, like today. In my own mind, I'd rather it didn't happen. It's easier to do my work and to be a normal person.
But does it increase your commodity in the sense of, well, it's not just Adam Johnson, it's Pulitzer Prize winning novelist Adam Johnson.
I will say, as a gift to a writer, it is the biggest gift because it means I'll have the freedom to write anything I want for the rest of my life.
Now, I did ask the question, which is, how has it changed you as a writer?
Mm-hmm.
And you answered more as to how it changed you, but is there a difference? Do you see a difference in the writing and sort of a maturation process as a result of something like that?
Writing is hard. It's just as hard. To face a blank page where there's nothing means you must create something. And that's as humbling and as difficult as ever. I think it would be harder if I, put my fingers on the keyboards and said, now, from the Pulitzer Prize winning writer today. I try to not think about that phrase. I have a friend at Stanford who won the Pulitzer Prize 33 years ago. And after I won, I took him to lunch and I said, what is this? How did this change you? And he said, well, for the last 33 years, no one has mentioned my name without saying Pulitzer Prize. And
right.
So get used to it. It's going to follow you.
Yes. So when it comes to the follow-up,
mm-hmm.
did you know it was going to be a story collection?
Well, I love stories. I love their coiled power. For me, a novel's a large construction that has... it's a collaborative effort that you make with your characters. It's a struggle with the form. It has all these large political dimensions, but with a story, you can be a dictator. And for me, a short story is a battery that stores emotion. And it can sit on that shelf for years, and when a reader comes to it, it's all released. And when a story ends, it's like a car that stops suddenly, and you're left rocking back and forth with the vibrations of it. So having written two novels back to back, I missed stories, and I could not wait to get back to them.
So in putting together this collection, what goes into that for you? we say story collections, so there is that act of collecting them.
That's right.
But do you say these are things that I specifically want for this collection?
Well, I think there are different kinds of writers. There are some writers who write outside of their own experience who will say, I'm going to go write about, you know, Mayan gods or submariners in World War II. And they do a lot of research and they create things that they're maybe not personally invested in. I only write from my own emotion. And there are many writers who write that way. It means you can't control when inspiration comes. You can't control when the feeling builds enough to inhabit a story and to drive a narrative. But, you know, at the same time that in our household, a Pulitzer Prize arrived, you know, my wife got a cancer diagnosis. Mm. And so that put a lot of tumult into the lives of our children and into our lives. And so there was a lot of emotion that poured into these stories, and I was not at a loss.
You write a lot about loss. You write a lot about love. You write a lot about disaster.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you find, to use your word, inspiring in that?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, emotion builds in an artist, and you can feel it start to fill you. Fill me, I should say. And I can tell my eye starts to look for opportunities, for occasions, for subject matter that seems to form a correlative with what I'm feeling, that seems evocative of what I'm feeling. And oddly, even though my stories are very personal of myself, I often connect them to things that are far away from my experience, from most people's experiences. And over the last 10 years, if there's a theme to my work, it is catching voices that you don't normally hear. And so in this book, there are a couple defectors who've made it out of North Korea. There's a Stasi prison officer, and not one Stasi officer has ever written a memoir to talk about that time. There's a sex offender, and it's so difficult in our society to hear the stories of victims of sex offense. It's even more rare to hear someone who's a human talk about, you know, what he was involved in. And it turned out in my own family, after my wife got cancer, she's a writer and a storyteller, she was weirdly silent on the topic, and there was a great silence in our house that I tried to fill as well.
Do you feel the necessity to fill that void?
Absolutely. It's an imperative. Yeah. I have students come to me and they're like, oh, I'm writing about two brothers and they have a problem. And are they going to reconcile? Or they'll say, oh, I'm writing about a marriage and I don't know if it'll make it. And they live in New England. And I think, you know, hey, these are important stories. But I also wonder, have you read Ann Beattie or Richard Ford? You know, like we have some of our great artists in society tackling these topics and capturing these voices. And that doesn't mean that they're off limits to new writers, but I would look to the tradition first. But there isn't a single memoir out there today of someone who committed violations, you know, against others as a sex offender. And to me, that's exactly what literature can do. You can use fiction to fill in a missing voice.
So when you hear your wife silent on her cancer diagnosis, mm-hmm. what void are you filling in? You're not speaking for her, you're speaking for you?
Well, that's a great question. She had her surgery and her chemotherapy after she had breast cancer. And then she said, look, I just want to move forward. I don't want to talk about this. And she didn't speak with her sisters, with her mom, with my mom, with her friends, with anyone. And I said, honey, she's a writer too. I said, honey, you have to write about it. She says, I'm never going to write about it. And I remember one night we went to a literary reading, and there was a bright young writer who'd written a short story that she read to us. And in the story, it's about a man and his wife dies of cancer, and he meets a young woman, and they start to date again, and everything's wonderful. And as I left the reading with my wife, she said, I can't believe he killed that wife with cancer in one line. She's like, that's the character I identified with, was the dead wife who's missing. And that was as much as she'd really spoken on the topic. And we walked all the way home, and she was fuming. And the next day I said to her, I said, you must write that story. You must write that story that got you all upset. There's your emotion. There's the narrative. And she said, I can't. And I said, but look, here's how it would work. And I spelled out how the first scene would play. And she said no. And of course, she's got to write her own material. I can't tell her what to do. But it was working in my head. And I started writing a story from my wife's perspective about her anger about cancer. And it became one of the more powerful stories I've ever written.
How do you think it would differ if, God forbid, it was you that had the cancer diagnosis?
First of all, you know, when something like that happens, it does happen to the whole family. And,
right.
You know, I wasn't the one, you know, facing the existential crisis. But it's also difficult to be a bystander. What I wouldn't have given to take that on. It's like, you know, when you have a child that's hurting, I would give anything to take that pain. If you could transfer pain, humanity would be a lot easier. We probably wouldn't need literature if I could just take your pain on, or we could share pain and experience it together.
But it's also a way of sharing pain.
That's
the literature.
Right. That's right. Through stories. And of course, stories are a meaning-making endeavor. It gives voice to experience. It recenters the self at the heart of experience. It charges all the elements with significance. And of course, it restores time and causality and structure to event. And a story is a meaning-making machine. And at the end of the story, you realize what that experience meant if you put it into narrative. And my issue with my wife was, you will never know what this meant to you unless you restore your voice, your language, time, plot, and all this stuff to it. You know, is it a sense of trespass to tell someone else's painful story? It always is, whether I'm telling the story of a North Korean defector. But yeah. I believe that risk, and maybe even violation, is worth it, because it's the only way you can share it.
Adam Johnson is our guest on The Book Show. The new book is Fortune Smiles Stories. It is published by Random House. Do you believe there are subjects that your wife or your family think that you should write about that you don't for a reason?
Oh, that's great. I thought this question was going to be the opposite. Like, does my wife wish I hadn't written a sympathetic portrait of a pedophile? You know,
yeah.
She was worried about that story. Just as a side note, I have a friend who works in the prison system in Arizona, and he runs a counseling group for sex offenders. And he also helps follow them after they're paroled and helps them adjust to society. He's a Christian. He feels called to the mission. And whenever I see him, he talks about the humanity of these people who've gone astray, people you and I would normally consider monsters and never want to see again. Year after year, he tells me about their human struggles to overcome their insurmountable mistakes and to rejoin society. And I wondered, well, I asked him, is there a book written by one of these people? And he said, no, there's nothing outside of professional literature. And I wondered if I couldn't use literature to go find that humanity. Like, could I make a portrait in which people would come to care about a person who was struggling to overcome impulses that had the worst consequences we could agree upon? I don't know. I think my wife would rather I hadn't written about her cancer, though she sees the importance of the story. But I think I'm a champion of her writing, and she is of mine. What would she want me to write about?
Well, there's nothing in your life or anything that you're holding.
Oh, that I would take on, like, to turn that gaze upon myself.
Yes.
And write about some great flaw or something. I feel like I lay myself emotionally bare in all my stories, even if they're not about me. Here's an interesting thing. In this story that I've just mentioned twice, it's called Dark Meadow. It's about a guy who is a victim of sexual assault, and as a mature person, he has impulses toward that. He keeps feeling these urges, these attractions to things that he shouldn't fulfill, like these girls who live in his neighborhood. He never does hurt anyone, but he has to grapple with this inner struggle of it. Part of the power of the story was from my own life. I cut alcohol out of my life a few years ago, and even though I didn't hit rock bottom or anything, but I saw that it was becoming a problem in my life, and I decided to get rid of it. But even after that, I would feel like these urges, like my brain would say, it's 5 o'clock, let's have a cocktail. Like the character in my story, these were urges that were bad for me. And I also found myself in the proximity of other people who were drinking all the time. And here I was, I kept finding myself very close to something that I couldn't partake in that would be bad for everyone involved. And so I did put something, I didn't out it necessarily, but the emotion of that experience is something I poured into this character to fuel the emotional dimension of his longings that were wrong.
I assume much of the concern that you have faced from people when you say you're writing this type of story is that we will sympathize mm-hmm. with that character.
It's the job of literature to provide a rich inner psychological landscape and to fully humanize every character. For instance, when I wrote The Orphan Master's Son, Kim Jong-il was a character in that book. Now, we all know this is a person who chose his nuclear program over the starvation of millions of his citizens. We know this is a person who runs family gulags, who endorses executions and torture. But when he became a character in my book, and I felt that as the dictator of North Korea, as the string puller of an entire nation, we had to get a look at that great script writer since he was responsible for everything. But when I made him a literary character, I had to humanize him. And I had to find his strengths, his weaknesses, his humor, his vulnerability, his intelligence. And I didn't really necessarily feel great about making a slightly sympathetic portrait of what we would normally consider to be a monster. But the second we call someone a monster and we take their humanity away, that means we've taken away our necessity to humanize with them. And then you can do anything to someone who's been dehumanized. And I think that's the great sin, is to say, oh, that person has hurt a child. He's no longer a human. While I don't want to necessarily be roommates with that person, once we take that person's humanity away, we've taken away all possibility of hope and redemption. And so I just feel like it's my duty to make real portraits. And if you do that, I believe in the Studs Terkel way, that if you get to know any human being on the street, at the bus stop, or the person who checks you out at the grocery store, you're going to find an interesting person. Maybe not a soulmate, but a person who's worthy of being on this planet with you. And I feel like that's my job. And unfortunately, people we'd like to dismiss are humans too.
Would you still be able to have the hope and redemption if that character did not have remorse?
The character, you know, in the story Dark Meadow, he's a guy who has been victimized himself, and it's written in the first person. I felt the story would be a little cowardly if I didn't have him actually tell the story and confess to what he feels inside. But it takes him a while to share with us what has happened to him. I mean, that's very difficult. And he does share with us that he has impulses toward two girls who live in his neighborhood. And I think narratively, I have a couple things going for me. First of all, I think readers sympathize with people who struggle to put their experiences into words. And for him, it is very hard to say, I am attracted to children. It is a thing that, you know, could get you killed, honestly, if you said that to the wrong person. I think readers also care about characters who are in traps. And he is in a trap. If he ever reaches out and even tells a psychologist that for help, the psychologist might have to report that. He might go directly to jail. He wants to not be attracted to children. He wants to be a normal human, but he cannot get out of this box. And the third thing is, all humans sympathize with people who struggle. And this is something my friend who works with sex offenders told me, that they're fighting a battle night and day to never offend, to never fall victim to these impulses they don't understand and that they're trying to change. And here was a character who maybe we go about our normal day and we have our wants and desires and problems. He is fighting all day to never do the worst thing possible. So weirdly, the story is ready-made to care about whoever's at the center of it.
One of the stories toward the beginning of the book is Hurricanes Anonymous, and I'm hoping you can read a little bit from that story.
This story is set in South Louisiana. It's in the wake of a hurricane, and our main character is a UPS driver, and here he is going about his route. He says, The boarded-up Outback Steakhouse next door is swamped with FEMA campers, and a darkened AMC 16 theater is a Lollapalooza of urban camping. It's crazy, but weeks after losing everything, people seem to have more stuff than ever, and it's all the junk you'd want to get rid of. Teflon pans, old towels, coffee cans of silverware. How do you tell your thin bedsheets from your neighbors? Can you separate your yellowed, mismatched Tupperware from the world's? And there are mountains of all new crap. Outside the campers are bright purple laundry bins, molded plastic porch chairs, and the deep black of Weber grills, which is what happens when Walmart is your first responder.
Adam Johnson reading from his story, Hurricanes Anonymous, from the book Fortune Smiles, a collection of stories. The title story of the book is Fortune Smiles, and it returns you to North Korea.
That's right. I researched North Korea for many years to write a book set there called The Orphan Master's Son. And I think I inadvertently suggested in that narrative that all you had to do was get out of North Korea and then your life would be happy and easy. When, having interviewed defectors and read the stories of many of them, I knew that it's just the opposite. When you go to Korea, when you talk to defectors, they have a great difficulty adjusting to life on the outside. And so here I portrayed two defectors who've made it out, and they were actually elites in North Korea, but still they're having a hard time.
Would the story be different if you hadn't written Orphan Master's Son?
You know, in writing The Orphan Master's Son, I came to care about the topic of North Korea and the plight of North Koreans a great deal. One of the difficulties with caring about North Korea is that it's very difficult to help them. If an earthquake happens in Port-au-Prince or a tsunami in Japan, within a few hours, there's a number people can text to donate $10. Or you can give to the Red Cross and feel, you know, very confident that, say, the UN is going to help a mission. But the thing about North Korea is that when the Red Cross and the UN deliver food, the government, the regime, steals it right away. And there are very few reputable NGOs working there. I've tried to give to some charities that seem to be operating there, but really the only thing I can do is give voice and use my language to do it. I interviewed two defectors to write this story. I was actually going to write a big nonfiction piece about them. One had been an elite in Pyongyang and had been a head propaganda guy. And the other one, a guy named Park Sang-hak, had been running a criminal car-stealing ring in a city called Chongjin. And since North Korea has no currency that's valued on the world market, and since they produce and sell nothing, if Kim Jong-un wants to buy rocket parts or champagne, he needs cash. And so all of the elites in North Korea run a kind of mob syndicate, counterfeiting money, creating meth, dealing heroin, doing all of this illegal trade to get real money into the country, like, you know, RMB, yen, euros, and dollars. And so this defector I met had North Koreans stealing cars in Japan, shipping them to Vladivostok, training them down into North Korea, where they'd cut the catalytic converters out, which were worth a couple $100 a piece. They'd reset the odometers and then dump them cheap in China. And so he had to do 1,000 cars a month. And if he did that, he had a big house and a nice car. And if he didn't, he was going to the gulags. And so even him, who had a Mercedes and a driver in North Korea, was really gobsmacked when he made it to South Korea.
It seems, and correct me if I'm wrong or you don't feel that this is an apt description, that in much of what you write, and I felt this way about the novel as well, that you are an optimist who is injecting yourself into hopelessness.
Ooh, that's an interesting description. You know, North Korea is kind of an intractable situation, but the indomitability of the human spirit really, really shows. I will say that when you meet North Korean defectors, you don't get to meet North Koreans, right? But when you meet defectors, these are bold people who've had the gumption to escape. I think one of the reasons there's no Arab Spring in North Korea is that anyone who might stand up in opposition to the regime is the kind of person who's going to run for their lives. But when you meet defectors, they're bold, smart, daring people. I think the darkness of their lives makes them funny people. There's even through translation, they're some of the funniest people I've met. And so I believe in the indomitability of the human spirit, and sometimes that's even brought out under the toughest conditions.
Adam Johnson's new work is Fortune Smiles Stories. It is published by Random House. Adam Johnson, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for visiting us once again.
This has been a wonderful interview. It's been my honor.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.